pull up a chair. I want you to stand next to one for a minute before I say a single word about where it came from. Because that's the thing about this airplane, you have to be standing next to it to understand it. I'm out on the Warbird ramp at Widman Regional Airport in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, where the Experimental Aircraft Association holds AirVenture every summer, and it is going on right now. This is Radio Hangar, I'm Taildragger, and this is The Hangar. And today we are talking about the biggest, heaviest, most improbable single-engine fighter the United States sent to war, the Republic P-47 Thunderbolt. Although nobody who flew her ever called her that. They called her the Jug, and she is enormous. You walk down the row past the Mustangs, and the Mustang is a beautiful airplane, lean and hungry-looking, all Merlin and Grace. And then you come to the Thunderbolt, and it's like walking from a racehorse to a Clydesdale. She sits up high on her gear. That four-bladed paddle prop is taller than you are. The cowling is this great blunt barrel of an engine, 7 tons empty and combat-loaded, more like 8. You put your hand on the leading edge of that wing, and it's up around your shoulder. Kids walk up to it here on the ramp, and just stop and look straight up. Now let me tell you where that bulk came from, because it is one of the great stories in aviation, and it starts with an argument. Before I get into it, let me tell you who's keeping the lights on today. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSold.com. Aviation Challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo private pilot, instrument rating all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. And friends, if there was ever an airplane that earned its coin, it was this one. Check them out at AviationSold.com. So, the argument? The man behind this airplane was a Russian immigrant named Alexander Kartveli, chief engineer at Republic Aviation out on Long Island. And in 1940, the Army Air Corps was asking for a new fighter, and everybody in the industry was chasing the same idea: light, nimble, small. The European fighters were small. The thinking of the day said a fighter should be a rapier. Kartveli looked at that thinking and went the other way entirely. Now here's where it gets interesting, because Kartveli didn't start his design with the wing or the guns or the cockpit. He started with the engine, the Pratt & Whitney R2800 double wasp 18 cylinders in two rows, 2,000 horsepower. And then he did something almost nobody else was willing to do. He built the whole airplane around a turbocharger. Understand what a turbocharger buys you. An ordinary engine loses its breath as you climb, because the air gets thin. But bolt on a turbocharger and you can feed that engine sea-level air at 20-25,000 feet, and it just keeps making power up where the bombers fly. That was the whole game in 1943. Whoever owned the high altitude owned the fight, but that turbocharger was the size of a trash can. It lived way back in the belly of the fuselage behind the pilot, and the exhaust had to run all the way back there, and the pressurized air had to run all the way forward again. Yards and yards of ducting snaking through the airplane. That's why the Jug has that deep, pot-bellied fuselage. That's the barrel chest. It isn't styling, it's plumbing. And then there was the propeller problem. 2,000 horsepower is useless if you can't turn it into thrust, and to bite that much air, you need an enormous propeller. So Kartveli hung a 12-foot paddle-bladed prop on the nose, and a 12-foot prop needs long legs to keep the tips off the runway. So the landing gear got tall, and tall gear folding into a wing pushes the guns outboard, so there was room for 850 caliber machine guns, 4 in each wing. You see how it goes. Everything on this airplane is big, because the thing next to it was big. It's like a snowball rolling downhill. It just kept getting heavier and heavier until the prototype weighed nearly twice what the little fighters weighed, and the pilots who first saw her did not know what to make of it. A 7-ton fighter, they thought Republic had lost its mind. Then they flew her. Let me set the scene for you. It's a fighter strip in England, 1943. Fog on the grass in the morning, that R2800. Does not purr like a Merlin, it rumbles. It's a big deep chest-shaking round engine rumble, and there is nothing on this Oshkosh ramp that sounds quite like it, and when one of these fires up here every summer, people 3 rows over turn their heads. A young pilot climbs up that long wing, and it is a climb, and drops down into a cockpit that is huge by the standards of the day. Rumi, the joke among the pilots, was that if a German got on your tail, you could just run around the cockpit and dodge him. She smelled like every warbird smells, hot oil, avgas, hydraulic fluid, and that particular Swedish smell of a big radial that's been run hard. And here's what those pilots found out. At altitude, up high where that turbocharger came alive, the Jug was a monster. She was fast, and in a dive, nothing on Earth could catch her. That 8 tons of Republic iron would come down out of the sun like a dropped anvil, faster than the enemy could follow, and the boys would come screaming down, hammer the target with those 850s, and use all that speed to zoom right back up to altitude. Dive and zoom. That was how you fought a Thunderbolt. You did not turn with the light fighters. You used your weight as a weapon, but that is not why the pilots loved her. They loved her because she brought them home. Now here's where it gets interesting, and here's the part I really want you to hear. That great heavy airframe, all that structure Kartveli built to carry the plumbing, turned out to be the toughest fighter of the war. There are photographs, and you can find them through the museums here, of Thunderbolts that flew home with cylinders shot clean off the engine. Home with 2-3 feet of wing gone, home riddled like a screen door, that air-cooled radial had no vulnerable radiator, no coolant lines to puncture. A liquid-cooled engine takes one rifle-caliber hole in the wrong tube and it seizes in minutes. The double wasp could lose a whole cylinder and keep rumbling. There was a pilot, Robert Johnson, one of the top American aces in Europe, and early in the war he got bounced badly, his airplane just torn apart, cannon and machine gun fire all through it. Canopy shattered, hydraulics gone, and he could not get it to burn, and he could not get it to quit flying. And a German pilot pulled up alongside him, out of ammunition, and emptied his guns into Johnson's Thunderbolt, and then just looked at him and shook his head and peeled away. And Johnson flew that wreck back across the channel and landed it. That airplane should have been a smoking hole in a French field. Instead, it taxied in. That was the jug. She was built to a philosophy that every other designer had rejected, and the philosophy turned out to be right for that war. You want to bring your young men home. And when the daylight bombing campaign moved into ground attack, when the Thunderbolts came down low to hunt trains and trucks and tanks in that last year of the war, all that toughness mattered even more. Down low is where the ground fire is. Down low is where airplanes die, and the jug soaked it up and kept flying. They gave up some of the high-altitude glory to the Mustang, with its long legs and its escort range, but down in the mud, hauling bombs and rockets and shrugging off flak, the Thunderbolt was the airplane the ground troops prayed to hear coming.
Republic built more than 15,000 of them, more than any other American fighter. And then the war ended and the jets came, and a machine that had been the very peak of piston engine fighting was suddenly scrap. Thousands of them cut up, melted down. A whole generation of these giants just gone, which is why standing on this ramp today means something, because the Thunderbolt is rare now, rarer than the Mustang, rarer than the Corsair. There are only a small handful of them left flying anywhere in the world. And it takes a museum or a foundation with deep pockets and stubborn patient people to keep one in the air. When one of them is here at AirVenture, parked out on the Warbird ramp, with the Warbirds of America folks watching over her, you're looking at something that came within an inch of vanishing from the earth entirely. And every year out here, somebody who is way too young to have ever seen one in her time walks up to that towering gear and that barrel cowl, and an older fella standing nearby, a volunteer, a Warbird pilot, somebody who knows, leans over and starts telling him exactly the story I just told you. That's how it survives. Not just the airplane, the story. Passed hand to hand on a grass ramp in Wisconsin, one summer at a time. That's the thing the EAA got right, and Paul Pobrezny understood it from the beginning. You don't preserve these machines behind velvet ropes. You fly them, you fire up that R2800, and you let a 10-year-old feel it in his chest. And maybe 40 years from now, that 10-year-old is the one keeping her flying. My thanks today to the EAA Warbirds of America, to the museum folks and the foundations who keep these airframes alive, and to the pilots and mechanics whose accounts fill the history books, including Robert Johnson's own telling of the day, the Germans couldn't shoot him down. You can find more on all of it at RadioHangar.com. Go find the Thunderbolt while you're here. Stand next to her. Put your hand on that wing and look up and listen for her in the pattern, because there's no mistaking that sound. This is Taildragger Blue Skies.